And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Elizabeth Crook to the program today. Elizabeth has written five novels, including The Night Journal and Monday Monday. Today we'll be talking about her most recent one, The Which Way Tree, and it's published by Little Brown. Elizabeth, most of your novels have been set in the 19th century in Texas. Being a Texan, the place isn't a big mystery, but why does the 19th century seem to have a hold on you?
You know, I think actually it is because my brother used to watch Westerns all the time, and he was 3 years older, is 3 years older than I am, and so he always ended up in control of the television set. So I would be watching something like Get Smart or, you know, some other program that I, Gilligan's Island or something, and he would come in and just change the channel. I think, you know, there wasn't really a rule about who could be in charge of the television. But because he was older and he was bigger, he would just do that. And so then we would be watching Gunsmoke or some other Western. And so I kind of got hooked on that time period and on that way of life, I think, you know, through no real desire of my own. And then by the time I was in middle school, you know, my favorite show was The Big Valley, and I was choosing it, you know, over the others. And so I really think it was that influence of kind of just watching a lot of shows with livestock and in the West and in that period that just created a kind of familiarity with that time and place that is compelling to me and still interesting.
Well, and having Barbara Stanwyck being such an imposing presence.
Well, she was. And, you know, that was the interesting thing is that I remember, you know, I was always annoyed with him for changing the channel in the beginning. But there was this one scene where a woman came out and she was being taunted by all of these scruffy-looking sort of cowboys who were around her house. And she had a rifle, and she came out on her porch, and she looked like a million bucks. And she said something like, "Does anybody want to try that again, cowboys?" And, of course, nobody did. And just that sense of her strength. And I mean, it was in those genres, you had a lot of strong women. And so I remember thinking, you know, wow, maybe there's something in this for me, you know. And then with The Big Valley, of course, Barbara Stanwyck just ran that show and everybody in it. I always, you know, I just was so in awe of her. So, yeah.
So do you think you're one of the current crop of the reinterpretation of the West and making sure that everyone is represented in the literature?
You know, that's never been my goal with writing. It really is more my goal to tell a good story. And in doing so, you usually end up, you know, making sure that everybody has a place in it, because those are the most interesting stories. But I can't say that I've had an agenda to sort of, you know, bring women more into the forefront in these stories. And, you know, and of course, in this book I've just written, even though Samantha, the little girl, is the one who sort of commands all of the action in a way, it's her brother with whom we, you know, the reader grows the most intimate, and the one that and who is the character I love the most.
Now, in the acknowledgments, you talk about how there was something that happened in your personal life that was a little spark for this story. So how did something that happens in the 2000s inspire this story set in the 19th century?
It just created this obsession I have with mountain lions. And what happened was that my son became lost out in the canyons in central Texas in the hill country. We were out there for a birthday party for my daughter, and she's younger, and we had all these partygoers and everybody and out at a place we have in the country. And my son, who was 14 at the time, and a friend of his decided they were going to go camping in a little cabin off in one of the canyons. And so they left at about noon. We went to check on them about 6. They weren't there, and they had never been there. We could tell from the dust still on the doorknob and the cabin being, you know, just as dirty as it had always been. And so for 6 hours they'd been gone, and we hadn't, you know, had any idea where they were. So we started looking and eventually ended up calling in the sheriff and various other people from Bandera County, the highway patrol. A lot of people came. And then by the time it was really dark, we had the helicopters come and start looking. And actually, I think my greatest fear was that maybe the kids, being 14-year-old boys, had decided to hitchhike somewhere, you know, just taken off. There were also a lot of things that can happen in those canyons. So the kids were finally spotted by helicopter. But in the course of this, there was this enormous mountain lion that was seen by the deputy sheriff and two others of the hunting party. And it was trailing up the main canyon that we knew the boys had intended to go down. And so it was going, we felt, in the direction that they had gone. So it began to feel to me like this race to get to the boys first. And it really is not the case that mountain lions just go and attack people. I mean, all the time. In those canyons, and particularly in Texas, there's just a lot of wildlife. So there wasn't so much risk that this big cat was going to kill the boys, but just the sense it was there with them, and it was prowling, and it was weirdly trailing behind the sheriff. You know, I mean, he saw it just, you know, sort of going along beside him on the ledge, and we knew it was out there. And so then when the boys were finally spotted by a helicopter through infrared, they picked up this little campfire. They'd made a little campfire down in a deep ravine. And then, you know, I said, well, I don't want the helicopter pilots to land and risk their lives to go down there and get them out. If we know where they are, we can get to them. But the deputy sheriff, knowing that that mountain lion was going that way, said, no, we're gonna land and get them out. So they did. He hiked down in, he flew them back. And for them, it was just like this adventure for kids. And, you know, I think my son remembers it mostly just as a kind of a time when he was, you know, lost and a little nervous and had only marshmallows to eat and was really thirsty, you know. But for me, what stuck with me was the fact that as the helicopters were taking off, I still remember so clearly the lights going from the helicopters and the sound of the rotor blades and everything. The deputy sheriff turned to me and he sort of had to shout over the noise. And he said, I don't mean to scare you, ma'am, but when I got there, that cat had its eyes on your boys. And so there was just that image of those eyes that stuck with me and created this, you know, obsession with mountain lions. And so I started researching and really, really sort of looking every night on Google, you know, doing it was my sort of bedtime routine, do this Google search for what had mountain lions, you know, done that day. Because there's always some little story, like they dragged off somebody's dog or something, you know, out in Utah or something. There's some story of interest. And now and then they will attack people. And so I got really obsessed with their depredations. And then I decided at some point that, you know, to sort of take this in a different direction rather than just Googling them every night and sort of researching to write this book.
Now, beyond the mountain lion or panther, as the locals call it in the Witchway Tree, there are a lot of animals in the story, both livestock and wildlife. And it seems that you very consciously have these animals have wills of their own. They're just not props for the humans to play off of.
Well, I like the way you say that. I think that's true. I mean, I just love animal behavior, and I like the goats in here, you know, the one that's always yelling. I mean, they're just such fascinating creatures. And yeah, they're their own things, you know, not just our things. So yeah, Zechariah, the panther hunting dog, you know, of course, is just such a character in the book. And then the livestock, the horses, of course, play a big role in the book, even though they don't have names. You know, they're called the Pinto and the Mare and the Gelding. But in a way, that allows them their own sense of, you know, integrity. They don't have names given to them by the people. But I like the way you put that. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but I do enjoy these animals, yeah. I grew up around a lot of animals, so.
Well, and it shows that that time and that location was a very much different place than we live in now.
The dangers that people faced every day were in most ways so much greater. And yet, I don't know, there's something so right about the sense that it was so authentic. It's sort of, you know, man against nature. It's survival. There's something very rooted in their existence. And I find when I'm reading about people in that period that there's a sort of a genuine sense of who they are from the beginning, and there's not all this searching that they do for who they're going to become, you know, so that you really get the sense of people being real people and not posing as anything else or not striving for anything else, but just kind of moving through life with that identity that they sort of came into as children.
At one point, a camel comes into the story, and it reminded me there was a movie in the 70s called Humps about the army had given camels to the cavalry.
Yes,
like right before the Civil War.
You know, I've never seen that movie, but that is what happened. I mean, they brought these camels in. Most of them came from Egypt. They brought them by ship. they landed them at the coast and marched them through Texas and up to Camp Verde, this area. That was where they were mostly stationed. And the idea was to see whether they would be able to transport all kinds of things down into Mexico and way out west to the other forts. And they actually did a good job, but there were a lot of problems in that they did not get along with horses and mules. Were very scared of the camels, and, you know, they didn't like the way they smelled, and so they tended to kind of stampede if the camels came through. There were issues with, you know, with the camels that kind of didn't work out, and they ended up, when the Confederates came in and took over Camp Verde from the Union soldiers who had been in possession of the camels and who had with them the people who had come from Egypt who knew how to work with the camels, their trainers, the Confederates didn't know how to deal with them. And so they just ended up, you know, sort of beating them all the time, trying to make them do things. So the whole experiment at that point really fell apart. And later, many of them ended up out in the West, some of them in a circus, some of them working in the mines out in the West, and some of them just kind of wandered free for a while and could be seen now and then kind of trailing across some lone prairie, this odd creature out there where it really wasn't ever intended to be.
Where the action of the book takes place, it's the hill country of Texas, so it's not exactly a flat desert like you would imagine the ships of the desert going across.
And their pads of their feet had a problem because it's very rocky there. You know, there was that other issue with them, too.
Now, The Witchway Tree is an epistolary novel, and the bulk of it is composed with letters from Benjamin Shreve, a young man, to a circuit court judge, Edward Carlton, in the 1860s. Why did you just want to give us Benjamin's side of the correspondence between the two?
Yes. You know, I wanted it to move quickly. I wanted it to center on this panther hunt. And I felt that if I expanded it to include this whole relationship with the judge, you can feel the sentiment of the relationship growing and that Benjamin really begins to sort of attach his longing for a father, because his father
he's in such need for a
died.
Connection.
Right. And so he's lonely. And so the judge, you know, tells him to write a testimony about, you know, this war crimes that happen. But Benjamin then just takes it and runs with it because he has time at night, you know, by himself. He just lives there with Samantha, his younger sister. So he really, really loves telling the story, and it gets longer and longer. And his letters to the judge, as he sort of fantasizes him into this kind of father figure, become more and more intimate. And you can sense toward the end his reluctance to end the book because he's going to miss this relationship. And he knows that when he stops writing this tale that, you know, that relationship is over. So I think you get all of the emotion of that relationship without having to see the return letters from the judge. You know from what Benjamin says that the judge is responding and that he sends him a pen and that he sends him these things that Benjamin really wants and needs. So I think you feel that growing companionship between them, even though they never lay eyes on each other again after that initial courtroom encounter when the judge tells him to write this testimony.
Because he does ride the circuit.
Yes, because he rides the circuit and he has to leave and he says he's going to come back. And then that what he needs at that time is just the letters. And then, of course, things happen.
What can you tell us about the war crime that Benjamin witnessed?
Right. So there were in the Hill Country during the Civil War, the Hill Country is populated with a lot of German settlements. Comfort and Fredericksburg and Burney, New Braunfels, those are all German settlements that where Germans came over. They were mostly or largely the free thinkers who were agnostic and very intellectual. And they were, you know, trying to get away from some oppression that was going on in Germany and some chaos there. So they came and they liked the idea of this land that they could then move into and sort of create their own civilizations. And so once they got here then, everything started getting stirred up about the Civil War. And then when Texas, you know, declared that it was going to join the Confederacy, there was a mandate that everybody had to sign up to fight, that men of a certain age had to be conscripted and sign up to fight. Well, the Germans didn't want to do that. Many of them didn't even speak English. And so the idea that suddenly they're going to be having to go off and leave these, you know, farms that they've started and these towns that they've founded and fight in a cause that they you don't believe in.
Yeah, they just gotten away from the revolutions of 1848.
Right, yeah. So they were really trying to, you know, to just have a peaceful existence. So they were very persecuted by the Confederates. They were killed. They were tortured. There was an enormous amount of brutality toward them. And many of them were just trying to kind of get to Mexico to get out of the middle of this. And so there was a group of men traveling, you know, to Mexico, and the Confederates caught them. And the incident that starts this that you're asking about, the war crime, they suspected that they were trying to escape to Mexico rather than going there for business. And it's very unclear exactly why they were going, but likely they were just trying to get out of Texas. They were mostly German families, and it was eight men and a young, well, seven men and a young boy. They ended up being captured by these Confederates. They surrendered their arms. They were told that they were going to be brought to Camp Verde, and there would be, you know, an inquisition, basically, as to where they'd been going and why. They started back, and then what happened was the Confederates somewhere along the way decided just to hang them. So they took them off as a group, and they strung them up, I mean, by all accounts, one by one, in front of each other. And the last one to die asked if he could be shot instead of hanged, and he was shot. And so then they were robbed of their things. And so this happened at a place right near Bandera, Texas, and the hanging took place from a tree that's now known as the Tragedy Tree. It still stands. It's a kind of scraggy-looking oak tree. Now there's a little marker there with the names of these people. But that was then after the war, during Reconstruction, these crimes were tried as war crimes, you know, during the war. And so they tried to track down who among the forces from Camp Verde took part in the hanging. And they couldn't find these. I mean, these guys had scattered. Some had gone, you know, back to states that they lived in somewhere else before. And one of them, I think, was tracked down. One report I was able to find was that one was tracked down and killed in New Braunfels while resisting arrest. But none of them ever were lawfully punished. Benjamin, my character, comes across the picking of the pockets by this one individual, Clarence Hanlon. And so that's why he is brought in to witness, you know, that Clarence Hanlon was one of the men from the Confederate Army that took place in the hanging.
And the group was known as the Hungerbande, the Hanger Band.
Well, you know, actually, it wasn't this group that did that hanging, but there was a group that basically was just a bunch of ruffians, and they went, yes, the Germans called them the I don't even know exactly how you'd pronounce it, but it's like...
The Hungerbande.
Yeah, okay, the Hungerbande, which, you know, was the hanging band, and they would go and hang people. I mean, they got people out of their beds, you know, Germans, and so everybody feared these people. But it was kind of all loosely constructed. There were some that were actually among the Confederate forces, and some were sort of just more ruffians that went around trying to make sure nobody was, you know, evading conscription and rounding up those that were. But yes, they were greatly feared by the Germans.
And Clarence Hanlon is the man who's on trial, and he is a no-account, no-account.
Yes, he's a bad guy. He's also a very pathetic guy in that you can see in the book that he really desires the confidence and affection of his uncle, the preacher, but at the same time, he does everything to lose that confidence and affection and to ruin it. And so, you know, I see him as just this person who from the very beginning was kind of a bad seed, but almost with no ability to overcome that destiny of being a bad seed, you know, not that smart and with a really mean streak.
Now, Benjamin lives with his half-sister, Samantha, whom he calls Sam, and we know through these letters that they survived the ordeal of the time. So in writing that, how do you balance kind of the tension with us knowing the fate of several of the characters before the story even starts?
Right. That was tricky, and, you know, you never know if you succeeded or not, really, in balancing the tension, but in order for Benjamin to develop this relationship with the judge, he had to be talking about his current life. And so we had to know that Samantha was still a part of it. And so therefore we had to know that she had survived the last ordeal in the book. So yeah, so you know from the beginning, you don't know whether they, you know, you don't know a lot of things about what happened with the Panther and what, you know, what eventually happens with her. Those all, you know, come to the forefront at the very end. But throughout the story, you know at least that both of these characters survived. You don't know about the two men, the Tejano, Lorenzo Pacheco, because the hunt, what happens is that these two kids, basically end up enlisting, or Samantha does more, the help of two men who help them to track this panther that has disfigured Samantha and killed her mother. And she is on this revenge quest. And so she gets Preacher Dobb, who has a panther tracking dog, and Lorenzo Pacheco, who is, you know, wanted for horse theft, basically, a very charismatic Tejano, to help her track the panther. And Benjamin gets dragged along sort of against his will throughout.
And it's ironic that we have this huge panther that is legendary in the area, and the attack happens on her when she's young and against her mother because of one of the smallest animals possible, the louse.
So basically, the father brings home this person who's working in the shingle camp with him. Turns out that this guy has lice, or Judah, the mother, suspects this. And so she throws him out. She is very obsessive about cleanliness in her home, and she begins to de-louse the kids with kerosene. That's what was used. There were, you know, the combs, the little tight combs they would use, and douse your hair with kerosene. So she does this with Benjamin. Samantha doesn't want this done to her, so she takes off running outside, and it's dark. And the panther at this point has been stalking the goats or something outside. Then it sees this little girl in this white nightgown go flying across the yard, and it's on her. And then Judah, the mother, runs out to take it on and to fight it.
And it's the first in a long line of tragedies that befall the family, into Benjamin and Sam being,
yes,
on their own.
Yes.
And the panther comes back. He is just a recurring presence of
yes,
of a power they cannot control.
Right. And Samantha almost wills it to come back. She's so desperately in need of revenge. I mean, her face is completely ruined by the panther's attack, so that she looks very strange. And it's killed her mother. After the death of the father, then she and Benjamin are just living alone. So she is really driven by one thing, and that is this desire, you know, for revenge.
And Benjamin has learned how to read and write, and he's actually exchanged items with prisoners of war in a POW camp that's close to Fort Verde. And one of the books he's gotten is The Whale, Moby Dick, mm-hmm, by Herman Melville. And Samantha is obviously Ahab.
Yes. Yeah, she is. And, you know, I put that in there a little bit, I thought subtly, but maybe it's not so subtle. But yeah, she's, you know, she is definitely Ahab, very different kind of Ahab, but driven by the same motive, you know.
And we do have a person with a wooden leg that pops up in the story very briefly.
Yes. Yeah, he can ride a horse really well.
Let's talk about Mr. Pacheco, who comes in when the kids need him the most.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I love him as a character. He's mysterious. He's kind of a Don Quixote. I mean, he comes riding through on this beautiful Pinto horse. And then when the kids are cornered by Clarence Hanlon, our bad guy, he appears to rescue them. So he is, throughout the book, you never really know what his past is. And you really never know so much what becomes of him. But he's a force within the story. And, you know, it's interesting because everything is told by Benjamin, who doesn't speak perfect English. Benjamin is able to, you know, tell exactly what Preacher Dobb says and tell exactly what Samantha says and what he says. But he has to tell about what Mr. Pacheco says because he can't write that kind of dialogue. And so you see Pacheco a little bit through, you know, this filtered lens of interpretation by Benjamin.
Because you see the transliteration
of the
Spanish words that he uses in his own spelling.
Yes, in his own spelling. I had so much fun with that character. I mean, all of these, because it's a small story and it's focused so tightly on, you know, this panther hunt. I'm in the periphery, of course, is the Civil War, the depredations, the things going on, the Comanche attacks, all of those things are going on in the periphery of the story. But the story, the driving, you know, part of the story is all about this panther hunt that takes place within a 3-day time span. And so you really get the sense, you know, a momentum from that, and the fact that there are only these four main characters in that we're dealing with intimately, who make up this posse that's hunting the panther. So you have, you know, Benjamin and Samantha. Then you have Preacher Dobb. Dobson Beck is his name. And then you have Lorenzo Pacheco, and you have Zechariah, the panther hunting dog. And they become the, you know, the focus of the story. And I love the fact that I was really able to deal with them coming together. They don't know each other in the beginning. Of course, you know, the intimacy between Benjamin and Samantha is complete. I mean, they live together, and he was there at her birth, you know, so they're siblings. But then, you know, they don't know Pacheco in the beginning, and they don't know Preacher Dobb. And so as this group becomes more and more intimate, and this real sense of affection and shared motive, but then also this discord when, you know, Benjamin and Preacher Dobb think they need to turn back because the dangers have become too great, and Samantha and Pacheco want to go on and continue the hunt, you know, then you have this tension of this discord between these two factions within these four people. But I love what it does in that they become a kind of a family, you know, in a way. And there's all of this, you know, disagreement in many ways, but there's this real sense of they are all good people. I mean, they're all people who have made grave mistakes and who are misguided in their motives in many ways and who, you know, have to confess to things from their past along the way. But they are good people. And so, you know, you sort of are with them, I think, you know, as a writer, I really felt with them. And I hope as, you know, as readers, people would too.
Well, and with Mr. Pacheco and Preacher Dobb both being older and Preacher Dobb have changing his life and becoming religious, that they've kind of put the machismo in their past. And Benjamin is a little too young to have that bravado going forward. So it's up to Samantha to be the driver of the group.
Yes. She just flat out refuses to do things and to turn back or anything that doesn't have to do with continuing to track that panther. And so even when Zechariah has been sprayed by the skunk and can't, you know, really smell the track anymore, and then the rain starts, and there are all these reasons they need to turn back, she forces this group forward, just this force of her will. And the fact that she is small and she's the only girl, but that all these men are just compelled because they can't force her to do anything different, they continue. They do what she wants them to do.
Now, was there such thing as panther dogs back in the day?
Yes, there were, and there still are. You know, the panther is actually, you know, a mountain lion. They called them panthers then. They had panther dogs, and they would track. A lot of times these dogs could track, you know, a lot of different things, but there are certain dogs that were trained for that.
When Benjamin is referring to the Confederate soldiers, he calls them secesh. Mm-hmm. And that's usually a term used by people who have union support. How divided was Texas at the time of secession?
It was very divided. Well, I mean, Sam Houston at the time resigned the governorship because he refused to pledge allegiance to, you know, they wanted all the people in the government to pledge their allegiance. And the story is that basically he sat there and whittled while his name was called repeatedly to come and pledge his allegiance. And he refused. And then you had, you know, all these settlements like the Germans. And then you had many people who were just not for it. So there was a lot of conflict. I mean, in different areas of the state, you had, you know, more leaning toward the Confederacy. But for a lot of people out west, there really wasn't that much in it for them.
There wasn't that much cotton out west at that time?
No. Mm-mm. No.
Now, while all these tragedies befall so many people in the books, there is a humor in the book. It is not a dour Russian drama by any stretch.
Yes. Surprisingly, it's a funny book. I mean, you can't describe the plot and make it sound funny. But, I mean, my mother was reading it and she was just chortling and she said, you know, she was kind of embarrassed and she said, am I supposed to be amused? And I said, actually, you know, I'm amused writing it. I mean, it's because Benjamin is so earnest in his storytelling, his take on things is so just genuine, and he has so much love for Samantha, even when she's being, you know, difficult. And these characters all relate in such an interesting way that the book comes across, I think, as funny. And, you know, in fact, when my editor, Ben George, who's just absolutely lovely, when we first spoke, and he had not yet bought the book, just wanted to visit with me first. And so one of the things I asked him was, do you think it's funny? Because I didn't want it to fall into the hands of someone who didn't get that part of it. And, you know, and he said, I think it's very funny. You know, so that was really gratifying to me. And that's when I knew, oh, I would love for him to buy this book. And I can't really explain why it's amusing, but it's just something. I think it's the language. I think if you stripped out Benjamin's storytelling and just told the story from an omniscient point of view, it would just seem very tragic in a way and hard, difficult life for these kids. But Benjamin is never self-pitying. You know, he never feels sorry for himself and doesn't really feel sorry, you know, for anybody else, because this is just the way things are. And that kind of erases your need as a reader to feel bad about what's happening, I guess.
And it's almost in the spirit of McMurtry and Portis, in which they had books that had very serious things.
True Grit is very funny. Yeah.
And
Lonesome Dove is funny. Which is really just one of my favorite books of all time. Both of those are. Yeah.
But I will say that it was really good to have that balance in there, because the terror of the panther attack scenes were so much. I mean, I can remember the last time I was scared in a book, and it's been a long time since I've been that frightened while reading a book.
Oh, well, that's nice. Thank you. I mean, not nice that it, you know, but that's nice of you to say. Yeah, no, I mean, it was terrifying to me writing it, just because. But the thing about writing violent scenes is that as the writer, you know, you're pulling the strings. You're the one, and you can stop pulling those strings. So you have a sense of control. I don't like to watch violent movies, and I don't like so much to read violent books, because I don't know what's going to happen, and it's in somebody else's hands, and it might happen unexpectedly, and I might, you know, it might be upsetting. But when I'm doing it, it's not as upsetting to me, because I know that I'm not going to take it so far, you know, that it can be unnerving, but hopefully it's never depressing, because I find a difference there. And so when it's in my hands, I feel really comfortable with the violence.
Now, on the back of the book and on the front of the book, too, you have great blurbs from authors like Daniel Woodrell and Attica Locke and Luis Alberto Urrea. But the name Robert Duvall kind of stands out amongst them all.
I mean, these were such generous people to give me these blurbs. I don't know most of these people. I know Sam Gwynn, but, you know, they were just kind and generous, and I was real pleased. Robert Duvall has optioned the screenplay. I mean, what happened was that I took it to my friend Stephen Harrigan, who's a writer in Austin, really great writer, and to look at, because he and I always edit each other's stuff, look at it and make comments and so forth. And I was about to send it off to my agent. It was a pretty rough draft. And so I took it over to see if he would read it one more time. While I was there, he said, you know what? He said, I know that Robert Duvall is looking for material, because he has a partnership with somebody that's a friend of Steve's there in Austin, and they were looking for material. And he said, you know, maybe he would like this. So he called up this partner, Eric, and Eric read it and said, I really like this. And so he gave it to Duvall, or Bob, as I've learned to call him. It hasn't come easily to me. And he read it and liked it. And so he optioned it, you know, right away. And he said, who would be the best person to write this screenplay? Whom would you suggest? And so I said Steve Harrigan, because he knows the story intimately, and he is a really good screenplay writer as well as a novelist and journalist. And Steve has been commissioned by the University of Texas Press to write the entire history of Texas. So he's very busy, and he had a lot to do and was behind schedule. And so he said, well, I don't have time to do it, but if you'll write it with me, then, you know, we can do this. And so I said, well, if you'll come over and help me download, you know, final draft, the screenwriting program, you know, because I've never even read a screenplay. I don't know how to do that. You know, he did. He showed me how to download. He showed me how to do it. And then I just made a stab at it. And then he showed me where I'd gone wrong. And we wrote this screenplay. And it was really interesting. What was so amazing to me was we would send off these drafts to Eric, Sally, the other producer, and Mr. Duvall, and they would read it. You know, within like overnight or within 48 hours, we'd have a conference call with their notes explicitly. And Bob Duvall is so good at this. I mean, he just, you know, knows what'll work and what won't. And with the working as a team was really new to me and very exciting, because it's collaborative. You don't feel as responsible for anything, because it's not really all yours like a book is. So I had a really great time working on this with them. Now, you know, at this point, it's all in their hands because the screenplay's done. We have the screenplay complete, and Bob Duvall is real happy with it. And so now, you know, the making of the movie is up to whether or not, you know, there are all these pieces to it that I didn't realize play into, you know, how it happens. And now you have to cut this scene or that scene for funding. I mean, like, the Panther will have to be computer graphics, and that's very expensive. And then you have the Flood, and that's also very, you know, so there's so many things that you have to kind of reconfigure. So I sort of stand by, and sometimes they say, okay, we need to go back into this scene and take this out or do that because we're adjusting the budget or something. But I'm real hopeful. I mean, Mr. Duvall seems to be pushing it straight through. I mean, he really is pushing hard on it, and he wants it to happen. So,
in writing the screenplay, since the story itself was epistolary, do you think that made for kind of an easier transition than like a normal kind of prose story would have?
Yes, and because everything has to be short and, you know, in dialogue and everything. And yeah, I could just yank some things out and cut them down and, you know, put them in there. And it, yeah, made it kind of easy.
So I know that's a big project, but do you have another book that you're working on right now?
You know, I don't. I mean, I feel bad about it because I know that I'm going to feel depressed the minute, you know, this one's really out in the world and I don't have another one that I'm working on. So I need to figure it out. But I really kind of would like to do something else with Benjamin, but I'm a little nervous to do that because I love the way I've left him here, you know, in this book. So I'm not sure if I'll do that or not, but I'm still drawn to that era and that place. And writing in first person like that made it so easy because what you can do in first person, and I don't really like books written in first person usually. I don't read them because I find that the narrator so often comes across as very self-absorbed because they're telling a story about themselves. But because Benjamin is doing this under mandate of a judge and because he's doing it, it's the story is about his sister really and not about himself. I think he escapes that kind of, you know, egocentric image that other first person narrators might take on. So what it does and what makes it so easy is that it streamlines everything to one point of view, and you don't have to go into so much descriptive detail. You can get the descriptions in a very subtle way through the storytelling, but when you're writing in, people don't usually describe things. They just say, like, we built a fire, and they don't say how they built the fire. And if you're writing it in third person, you have to put in a little more description, or it comes across as very flat. But if you're writing it from a language of a person, you don't have to put in all that description. So it's all action and dialogue, and it moves very quickly. And I really, really enjoyed writing that way. It came very easily compared to my other books.
How quickly did his voice come to you?
His voice came to me. I read a lot from, you know, the Civil War letters and papers and times and journals and Texas, you know, first person documents that were left. And once I got the sound, you know, but the main thing was I found this book. It's called Now You Hear My Horn by James Wilson Nichols. It's a memoir that he wrote, and he lived during this time. And his language was so fresh and authentic and unpretentious and yet very elegant in its own way. And I just loved the sound of that. It was a book that I came across that my grandmother had given to my grandfather, you know, many, many years ago. I just read it two or three times enough to really get the sound of it. And then I, you know, I think Benjamin's voice settles into something a little bit different, but it has a little bit of that same feeling, you know, to just the way the sentences roll out. They go on a beat longer than a lot of sentences spoken today, and yet they're not florid or pretentious in any way. It's just a carrying on that makes them a little different. I had a lot of fun writing in his language.
Well, Elizabeth, thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing the Which Way Tree with us. It's been a pleasure.
It has been a pleasure for me. Thank you so much for having me.
Elizabeth Crook is the author of The Which Way Tree, and it's published by Little Brown. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.